Hello and welcome to Finding Focus. This is a new podcast made by me, Christina Weber. I am a visual artist based in Edinburgh. I've lived here for almost 10 years now. And this essentially aims to be a really informal chat between me and a handful of photographers that I admire, talking a bit about how they kind of found their way into the photography industry and on a particular project that I have asked them to talk about. This is definitely an experiment at this stage, and due to the current situation, I do not have access to some of the equipment that I would like, as we're all in lockdown, but I thought it would be a good opportunity to just get the first few out there anyway, as I think people could use a pint and a chat right now. So please let me know what you think. All feedback is welcome. I really want to make these better and continue to improve, so any support or advice would be great. Me and Dave recorded this in January 2020, so that was before he had released his most recent book, The River Isn't Yellow in Winter, which you can now actually buy via his website. So all of this chat occurred before that was released, and it is now out in the wild, so look it up. It's a real beauty. I have one on my desk right in front of me. You can stalk Dave online at daveferry.com, where you can find his Instagram details, his Facebook, his email, and even his mobile phone number. Thank you so much. Please enjoy. This is Finding Focus.
Okay, so as you may have already said in the recording, depending on how much you've cut. The project I'm working on just now is titled The River Isn't Yellow in Winter, which comes from the Yellow River in China. I was in a city in China called Lanzhou, which the Yellow River runs through the middle of. But in the winter, the river is not yellow. It's bluish green like any other river.
What time of year did you visit?
It was winter, what year are we now, 2020? It was winter 2018/19.
So you've never seen the river yellow?
I have not. I hope to go back this summer, but we'll see what happens. But anyway, my girlfriend is from Lanzhou, and she was going back last winter to visit her parents over the Christmas break and asked if I wanted to go with her. So I was there for around 3 weeks and spent mostly every day just walking around on my own, taking photographs of the city. Which is my dream state. I love visiting a new place, especially a city, and just walking around taking photographs. And that's kind of how I make, the only really time I make work these days is when I'm visiting somewhere and just walking around. So yeah, it's a pretty big, I mean, if I haven't met her, I would never have ever heard of this city in my whole life. It's like fairly big by European standards. It's like 4 million people, but by Chinese standards, that's pretty small. And there's not a whole, the biggest thing of significance from Lanzhou is Lanzhou beef noodles, which everybody in China knows. So I went there not knowing really anything about the place or what it looks like. Obviously they don't have Google Street View in China because Google's banned. So I couldn't even look at it on Street View and see what it looked like.
I didn't know that.
There you go. I mean, if you go on Google and type in Lanzhou, there's some images, but not a great variety of them. Anyway, so I went there. It was pretty cold. It was the middle of winter, and it's in the desert, so it was like extremely dry. It didn't rain. I think it rained once the whole time I was there, and snowed twice, and that was it. Which was nice for a Scottish person in the winter time to not have to deal with any rain or snow for a change. And yeah, just had a great time, to be honest. I don't know the city or China well enough to say anything particularly meaningful in terms of like whether it's good or bad or whatever for the people there, or for the environment or whatever. But walking around, I could definitely see, how to put it, that the people or the size of the city had an effect on the environment, if you put it that way. Which any city of 4 million people will have, regardless of where it is. And I guess the project is partly about this conflict, if you want to call it, between humanity and nature, but also partly about my own personal conflict between, or struggle between, my love for cities and human progress, but also realizing that nature plays a big, well, I mean, we won't survive if nature isn't thriving, I guess. It's very important to our survival and the survival of all the other species on the planet. So. Yeah, I mean, I think in Scotland we're very lucky that we have, well, I mean, Glasgow and Edinburgh aren't massive cities anyway, but we have, I mean, in Edinburgh you have Arthur's Seat within like 20-minute walk from the city centre. In Glasgow you have massive parks, Kelvin Grove and Glasgow Green, within an easy walk from the city. We're very lucky to have green, almost wild, but not really wild, but feel like wild spaces accessible if you want to escape. But it's not like the city is that busy or bustling that you really, apart from in fringe season in Edinburgh, there's definitely a reason to escape then. But
no, no, there is no escape.
There's not really the, there are not massive metropolises where you feel the need to escape and get some fresh air or freedom over. Whereas in Langeau, maybe it is just on the edge of a kind of big enough city where it feels a little too claustrophobic or a little too man-made sometimes. But I also love cities and smog and car fumes and everything else that comes with big cities. So yeah, there's a, I don't know, a kind of personal conflict, but I also don't really want to say anything positive or negative about the way people are living there or the way people are living in general. It's more just an observation. You know, it is what it is. I'm not trying to like change the fucking world with my pictures or make people think differently or act differently. I'm just showing how things are, I guess.
But you are pointing a finger at
yeah, certain things. Yeah.
The destruction. Not necessarily the destruction, but
I would say, yeah, I'd say disconnect is a better word.
You say disconnected, but I think actually in a lot of the pictures you do see kind of the strange coexistence of the natural world.
That's
and,
true.
And
that's true.
The
yeah.
Hundreds of people.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
That seems to actually be quite a common kind of visual theme throughout the dummies that I've seen so far, is that it is kind of like a balancing act, like you are consistently balancing images of urban landscape but with little natural details.
Mm,
like, it's obviously
true.
Something that you were looking for on some level.
Yeah, and I mean the river is very, well, I guess important to me and to the city and to China in general. The Yellow River is like the second biggest river in China. And back in the old days it was very important for like trade routes and stuff like that. Now it's less so. But I mean it runs through the middle of Langeau, and Langeau probably wouldn't be there if it wasn't for the river. It's right in the middle of the desert. There's not really much reason to have a city there if it wasn't for the river. And you can see, like, I've talked about this with you before, like, for example, the River Clyde, where I'm from in Glasgow, no one goes there. It's a dead zone now. There's one shipyard left. It used to be full of shipyards, obviously, but now there's one left, I think. But, like, people don't go there for recreation or for any reason, basically. Whereas the Yellow River, people would go there with their kids because there's like sandy beaches on the banks of the river. People would go there even in the middle of winter to make sandcastles and fly kites and all kinds of recreational.
See, how is that about disconnect? Surely that
yeah,
is about
that's true. That's
purely
correct.
Connection.
Yeah, but it's also the riverbank is a very managed place because the Yellow River floods frequently. So they have like big kind of, not dams, I don't know what you'd call it, like a man-made buttress to stop the river.
A flood defense.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for, thank you. To stop the river overflowing into the city. Although it looks natural, it's also very managed. So it's an interesting kind of combination, or like, I don't know. And also I haven't been in this summer yet, but I plan to go back either this year or next year in the summer. And the river is, from what I hear, much higher. And obviously yellow. Thank
much
God.
Yellow.
Yeah, thank God. But the riverbank probably isn't accessible in the summertime because the river level rises. So I don't know how people, if maybe their behaviour with the river changes in the summertime. I don't know.
Where are you at the moment with this project? Where are you? Talk me through it.
Okay, so...
I mean, I already know.
Yeah, I mean, you've spent the last year listening pretty much a year going through... I'll say the number. Everybody wants to hear the number. So, I took 15,000 pictures, which... Yes, too much, but it is what it is.
I mean, it's too much for me, but
it's too much for anybody. No one should take that many pictures in 3 weeks, but I did. And
it's digital, do what you want.
Yeah, but then you have to fucking... The pain comes from having to sit and look at them, but I guess I didn't have anything else to do, so it was fine. So I got that down to about 100.
Can we
just...
Can we just... Whoa. 15,000 to 100.
There was a lot of shit pictures there. Just for anyone, for any aspiring photographers listening, they should just know that everybody takes so many shit pictures. Even all your heroes take hundreds and thousands of shit pictures. So don't feel like... We only show the good ones. Don't feel disheartened. I don't know why I'm looking at the microphone and talking to it as if, like, people...
Like it's
your power. But yeah, anyway, so I got it down to about 100. And I think now I'm down to about 75 as well. And I'm starting to lay out the book.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about shooting in colour, as I know your last few books have been black and white, and maybe what prompted that decision, and how you are finding working with colour as opposed to a purely black and white publication.
Well, as you know, I worked purely in black and white for a good few years, but I think it was... I kind of just wanted a change, but also I don't really know, but for some reason I'd seen like pictures from China and they were all in colour, and it kind of... the feel of it or the mood of it was quite inspiring for me, and I kind of just wanted to try it in colour and see what happened. And I did strangely have like a vision in my head of what the colour palette would be before I even went there, and it was quite true to what it turned out as. But I don't know if that is purely, or like how much of that is down to the smog, because the smog does act like a kind of just giant like diffuser and makes everything, like, even when it's really sunny, it just makes everything really nicely lit and beautiful. I mean, color is very, especially nowadays, it's very easy to manipulate to make it look however you want, basically, put it that way. Although I do try to keep it quite realistic, I also kind of use it, and at least I'm trying to use it in this book, as a way to kind of set a mood, let's put it that way.
It's not to sound like I didn't believe in you. But it's surprising when you're so used to someone only producing black and white pictures to then see such a large collection of colour images, where I do think that the colour plays a really important part, and that I think are really nicely balanced across the whole project. And would not have worked at all in the same way if they had been
in
grayscale. So it's kind of like you've unlocked a whole new tool in your toolkit, and you've just like done really well with it.
I think it's more just the mindset, because obviously I mean the project I did before this was in New York, which to me, I don't really know why, but it to me just seemed like a very black and white city.
I think that's New York.
I don't know how much sense that makes, but I went there already with a vision in my head of roughly what the book I wanted to make was. It didn't turn out exactly like that, but I definitely wanted to make like a gritty street black and white book, if you want to call it that, which kind of came out like that in the end. Whereas with China, it just seems much more gentle. I don't really know why that is. And it might have been different if I'd went to Beijing or Shanghai or one of these massive cities, but...
I think it's the big beauty fog diffuser.
Yeah, possibly,
it's the big
layer
of smog.
Yeah,
like...
I think there is like a... I don't know, a gentleness to China and to the people and to the colours there that just... I don't know, it just works well for colour. It'll be interesting to see... I really don't know what I'm going to do next, and if it's going to be in... I feel like I'm on a colour kick now, so I'll do colour for a bit and then see how I feel. But I mean, if you see a colour photograph, you expect it to be like real life and as close to real life as possible. So maybe it's just that the China was a novelty to me and to most of my viewers, I guess, where I wanted it to be realistic. I didn't need a abstraction to make it interesting. Maybe that's why. But yeah, I am enjoying working in colour. There is a lot more to it than I realised or anticipated at first, I guess.
I guess in a similar way to you moving away from using black and white, even if it's only temporarily, this publication seems set to be quite different from your existing work anyway, because it doesn't have, as far as I'm aware, you're not planning on putting text through it, or at least not the kind of text that people might associate with your work, which is very stream of consciousness, kind of like raw, quite engaging, almost personal text, which kind of roots the pictures into a narrative, and unless you've changed your plans dramatically since the last time we spoke about it,
I don't think
you're planning on doing that.
No, partly, well, it's for a number of reasons that I'm not planning to include text. Partly it's just a change again with the, like with colour. Partly it is because although I thought the photos and text worked quite well before, I'm a little concerned that I used it as a crutch, and maybe the photographs wouldn't have held up on their own without some kind of text or narrative. And partly it's because I hope, I don't know how this will ever go or how it's going to pan out, but I hope that the book will be read or appreciated in China as well as in the West, or whatever you want to call it, Europe. And having text, although I could easily get it translated, I think there's always something a wee bit lost in translation. There we go. I think there's always a wee bit of like meaning, especially if it's very personal. I think there's always a wee bit lost when words are translated to a different language, especially when the culture is so different from ours. So, yeah, and I guess I think this is probably the only time I feel that the images are strong enough to exist on their own without text.
You don't. You also don't want to just force some text out because you feel it's expected of you. That's
yeah,
not
that's
being lazy. That's just, you know, being a liar. being inappropriate.
That's true. I mean, yeah, I guess it depends how much explanation I feel there needs to be.
And in terms of format, all your books have been quite small.
Yes.
So far. What are you thinking? And how do you decide that? Is it something that you just seem to know? Because you seem to know exactly what your books are going to be like before you even go to the places.
This time I didn't, but yeah, before I kind of knew already. This time I didn't, but I mean, I prefer small photo books, and it's also about cost as well. Small books are just easier and cheaper to produce. So it's probably going to be roughly A5 size. Probably exactly A5, because that seems to be the cheapest option. So I don't know, there's something nice about small books where you can just put them in your bag and take them with you on a bus journey or whatever. Like, big photo books have their place, and they are definitely sometimes very beautiful to look at, but it's the kind of thing that's more difficult to share or take somewhere with you.
Have you considered a fold-out print?
I have, but this is, I don't really want to get into this, but if we're going to start talking about like what I consider gimmicks in photo books, which
fold-out prints will
yeah,
be on the list,
or,
okay. Moving on.
It's, listen, if I had a publisher, which, I mean, again, this is one of those pipe dreams that doesn't exist. If I had a publisher paying for all the printing costs, which doesn't exist these days, basically, unless you're fucking Alex Soth or somebody. And they were happy to do a fold-out, then sure, I'll do a fold-out, but I'm not. The amount of expense they bring, I don't feel is worth it for me. But and it's also kind of, they're a bit finicky. I don't really like them even when I'm looking at books and having to like, it's nice to break up the rhythm a wee bit,
I love a folder.
But I'm just not into
it's
that.
Like an Easter
and like
egg.
When people have like different paper stocks in the same book and
no, I like that.
Yeah, I know you do. You're all about that. For me it's slightly unnecessary. It's more about designing a nice book rather than just showing the photos in the best possible way. There are loads of books with mediocre photographs, but they use nice design and nice paper stocks, and it does elevate the work above what it would normally be. But it also does feel like a wee bit of a crutch to me, like something that they kind of know that the pictures aren't strong enough to stand alone on their own, so they have to make other wee bits and bobs and add in, and I'm just not that interested in it. But again, if someone was paying for it all, then I would go to town, get the foil embossed cover with the inlaid print in there. Yeah, but that's all just, I suppose for me, I just want to keep the books as affordable as possible because I want it to reach the biggest audience as possible. There's a Dutch guy called Ed van der Elsken, who died in 1990, I think. But his books are some of my, I think he just really knew how to make a successful photo book. So his first major one was called Love on the Left Bank. And it was like a fictional love story, I guess if you want to call it that, about yuppies in Paris in the 50s, where they were just like, not really employed, just hanging around, taking drugs, whatever else, and having a good time. But I mean, individually the photographs are quite good, but I wouldn't say they're like amazing. But as an actual like story, it's really just a brilliant book, really nice. And he's got various other ones, although some of them are difficult to find. And it took me, this was like my holy grail of book collecting, that I looked for one called Sweet Life, and I finally found an affordable copy last year. I was so happy.
Where did you find it?
eBay.
Oh,
you can get photo books really cheap on eBay, everybody. Don't sell your books on eBay, but but if you want to buy books, because there's not many people, it's a pretty niche community, so there's not many people looking out on eBay for them, it seems. Yeah, maybe I've just ruined it. But.
Yeah, they're going to go up in price a whole ton now.
No, I'm sure they won't. No one's listening to this anyway, so it's fine. But yeah, I mean, there's lots of great photographers making books, but there's also a lot of people churning out mediocre books and books that really don't need to be made, but they get made because it's got a famous photographer's name attached to it. Otherwise, no one would buy it. There's one about skies, I'm not going to name the photographer, but a famous male colour photographer made a book about skies, like blue and white skies, and the whole book is just that. And it's just like, if anyone else made this fucking book, no one would give a shit. But because it has this name, person's name on it. So yeah, it's a difficult world to navigate. And then this book costs like £40, and then you buy it, and then you think, what the fuck did I spend? I mean, I didn't buy this book.
I'm saying, you do make the decision.
Yeah,
it,
but
it's, like
it's difficult. You don't always get to see, you know, what they look like before you buy it. So,
yeah.
But yeah, in Scotland, it's difficult to find. I mean, street level have some books. Stills have some photo books, and I'm gonna have to mention Good Press, because without them, that was really where I started making photozines, was because I saw them in Good Press, and I didn't even know that was a world that existed until that point. They're a little independent bookshop in Glasgow, and they stock shitloads of self-published artist books and have a pretty good selection of photo books as well, all self-published, or mostly all self-published. So I started selling zines there for like £2. My first one ever was £2. Pissing about in Glasgow.
It's cool.
If anyone has it, it's a rare one now. But I did a couple of
different. It's probably expensive.
I did a couple of different versions of that because it was such a good title. I think it got to number 3, and then I stopped making it.
So you work entirely in books, am I right? You, I've seen your work exhibited, but you are really interested in books.
Yeah, I mean,
primarily.
The exhibition was purely for the experience. I mean, I'm not that interested in exhibitions.
Yeah.
But if someone wants to come and offer me an exhibition, then please, by all means. But I mean, when I first started out in photography, I put on a couple of exhibitions in Glasgow, which I paid for. They were like one night deals. paid for the space myself, paid for the printing, everything, hung the pictures myself. My friends came, hang out, had a drink, and then I took all the pictures down at like midnight, and that was it. I mean, they were fun, but it wasn't worth the hassle, in my opinion. And I still don't think, to me, I think it's just that I haven't been able to figure out a satisfactory exhibition format for myself yet, I think is the big problem.
I mean, I'm intrigued to know what, without turning this into an argument about books, I'm intrigued to know what to you makes a book more worth it or more satisfying than an exhibition where you can see people reacting to the work and have discussions with them about it presently, as opposed to a book where you just kind of let it go and then you don't really know if people, what people think or if people are even reading it, you know, it just kind of goes out there and has a life of its own. What about that as a format, that, what is it that appeals to you?
Well, I guess that a book is more, well, it's more permanent, but it's also more distributable. So, and if you, I mean, like I said, I had those exhibitions that were one night only. If you can't make it that night, you're not going to see the work, and that's the end of it. But if I have it in a book form, it'll exist for, you know, however many years, hopefully, and I can send it to you wherever you are in the world. Plus, it's, for me, photography, I guess because I always came to photography through books and through very solitary experience. For me, it's looking at photographs is a very solitary thing. I don't really like doing it with people or with friends, even, because then it kind of forces you to have a conversation about it, whereas I just want to think about it in my own head and not really like take time to digest it before I discuss it, I guess, maybe.
So a slower process.
Yeah. And you can like flick through it at your leisure and return to it over and over again if you want. I mean, I'm not saying the exhibitions, they definitely have their place.
I just
don't think they're currently for me. I might change my mind somewhere down the line. Maybe it's just that I can't afford to make a really nice exhibition that I would like to, but...
Well, I mean, I definitely agree that there's not really a... It's not an exchange of energy, because a lot of energy goes into an exhibition, and then you don't get a... Depending on how you operate it, there are ways in which you don't really get anything back from it, or not a lot back from it, even if you have discussions at the opening with people. A lot of the time, I mean, I don't know of many exhibitions where someone is always present to watch or listen, you know. I guess in the same way, you then just let it be up and people can see it if they want. And it is a massive expense and a big energy expense to do that, to then just take it all down again. I do understand that aspect of it, but I think it's like with books and with films, they just exist outside of you, and then you don't really have any discourse from it. There's no dialogue.
Maybe that's kind of nice. Maybe that's what I want, just to put out in the world and then just move on to the next one and not think about it too much. I mean, I think if I'd come to photography through a college or university, I would probably appreciate exhibitions more, because there is that communal aspect and group aspect to it, whereas a book is very much, for me, it's very much a solitary thing, endeavour, unless you're doing it with collaboration, but even then, it's only you and a couple other people. I don't know, I think it's also just books affect me more than exhibitions ever have. I can only name maybe like one or two exhibitions that I've ever been to that, and it's pretty harsh, but that I've ever been to that have been, I don't want to say life changing, that's too much, but like made me really consider photography, I guess.
Meaningful, like.
But in terms of books, there's hundreds that I've seen, photography books, and books in general, but mostly photography books, that have been really meaningful to me and changed how I think about photography, I guess. So.
Thanks so much for listening, if you did listen. This has been Finding Focus. Thanks also to Lawrence Turner for the lovely intro and outro music. If you liked this, then please like, subscribe, follow, share, retweet, tell your friends, spread the word. It really makes all of the time that goes into this really worthwhile just to hear your comments. So that's, please do if you liked it. And I'll be back with the next episode talking to Louise McLachlan. So do stay tuned. Thank you.